ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, Australia's inflation dragon comes roaring back to life, setting back the hopes of those counting on further interest rate cuts. Also, the mistakes of history. A hard lesson for Queensland school students taught the wrong subject for their Year 12 exams. How could it happen? And the day of the black T-shirt. The Prime Minister's clothing choice creates political controversy.
I'm in a T-shirt, and I think the opposition are just clutching at straws.
It's distracting from all the big things that we need government and the opposition to deal with.
There are now long odds on a Melbourne Cup Day interest rate cut after annual inflation recorded its sharpest quarterly jump since 2022. The latest data shows consumer prices rising at an annual pace of 3.2%. That's up from 2.1% in the June quarter. The Treasurer Jim Chalmers says state-based energy rebates coming to an end caused part of the spike, but economists argue there's more at play. Rachel Mealy reports.
Stan Jeller plays his piano accordion on the steps of Flinders Street Station in Melbourne to make a few extra bucks. He's on a pension and has been struggling with the rising cost of living.
Oh, gas, mostly gas, electricity, very expensive. I pay $200-$300, you know, every 2 months for gas and electricity. Just from the pension, you pay that out, nothing left for you.
Roslyn says she's noticed prices pick up across the board.
Everything, the food bill is expensive. Yes, I don't know. And the power bill, I'm not even home most of the time, so how can it be so high?
While Steve says he's finding it tough to make ends meet.
I'm on Centrelink at the moment. I'm drug free. I don't use any alcohol, I don't poison, and I just get by. Groceries, just me, single man. Groceries are costing me about 120, 140 bucks a week and doesn't leave much in the change, you know, for anything else.
Earlier this week, Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock warned that a core inflation figure of 0.9% would be a, quote, material miss compared to the RBA's forecasts. Today's figures reveal that trimmed mean inflation came in at 1% for the 3 months to September and 3% over the year. Today in Parliament, that point was driven home by the opposition.
Given the Treasurer always takes credit for when inflation falls, will he now take responsibility for today's news of inflation increasing?
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, downplayed the sharp rise and says the uptick was a result of state energy rebates coming to an end.
In these numbers today, inflation is higher than we'd like, but it is around half what we inherited from those opposite. And so if those opposite want to make this point about inflation at 3%, what do they say about inflation that they had running north of 6% and rising when we came to office? Inflation is half what we inherited from those opposite, Mr. Speaker.
Headline inflation rose 3.2% over the year. That's a 15-month high and sits above the top of the RBA's target band of 2 to 3%. Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock may have spoken too soon on Monday night when she talked about the RBA's achievements so far in slaying the inflation dragon.
You know, I don't want to count my chickens too soon, but what we've managed to achieve in bringing inflation back down and managing to maintain some of the gains in the labour market, for me, has been a very satisfying outcome.
It's not good news for borrowers. Many economists say the likelihood of a rate cut next week is now almost zero. Deanna Messina is chief economist at AMP.
I mean, look, I was disappointed that the inflation outcome was so high. I think it's been great to see Australia making such good steps in getting inflation down, and it's frustrating to see a bit of a reversal in that. And it's also, it's not evident, you know, that it's just in a specific number of categories where this is happening. It just looks like we've seen a broad tick up in inflation, particularly for goods, and services prices remain quite elevated. And I think it's also disappointing that it means we won't get a rate cut at next week's meeting, which I do think is still needed for the market economy and for the consumer as well.
AMP Deputy Chief Economist Deanna Messina ending Rachel Mealy's report. Reports of major damage and missing families are emerging in the wake of Hurricane Melissa, the Category 5 storm smashing into western Jamaica with winds up to 300 kilometres per hour. It's been dubbed the storm of the century, directly hitting the Caribbean nation of nearly 3 million people, cutting power, damaging hospitals and causing major flooding. Cuba is now bracing for the storm's force, as Alison Shaw reports.
As the eye of Hurricane Melissa passed over Jamaica, brutal winds lashed the coast.
Trust me, it's not no joke.
The storm made landfall in the Caribbean island as a powerful Category 5 storm with winds close to 300 kilometres an hour before hurtling towards Cuba and the Bahamas. Locals hurried to evacuate in Cuba's second largest city, Santiago de Cuba.
We are thinking the worst will happen. I think it's coming with strength, and we want to preserve our lives.
What I want is for nothing bad to happen, to find my home as I left it when I return, and that the thieves from here don't steal my refrigerator.
In Jamaica, reports are emerging of destruction and the missing. Almost every region in the country is experiencing blocked roads, roofs torn off buildings, fallen trees, and excessive flooding. In the country's southwest, the parish of St. Elizabeth is said to be underwater. Desmond McKenzie is deputy chair of Jamaica's Disaster Risk Management Council.
Jamaica's gone through what I can call one of its worst periods. Our infrastructure has been severely compromised. St. Elizabeth is the breadbasket of the country, and that has taken a beating.
Senior reporter with Kingston's Jamaica Gleaner newspaper, Javon Johnson, says the past 24 hours have been devastating.
It's a whirlwind. I mean, we were all told that this was going to be catastrophic. It started and it has left a trail of devastation. I know we're accustomed to that term, but there's no other way to describe it as it lashed the southwest of the country. I am in Kingston. We have no power in some parts of Kingston. Pretty much majority of Jamaica is without power.
The Jamaican journalist warning too, the full scale of the damage is yet to be determined.
Lots of communities marooned, cut off, down power lines, land slippages. You'd have homes submerged more to the center of the country as well. So we don't even have a good sense of what has happened further inland.
Javon Johnson fears the island nation will face a long and difficult recovery.
There's hardly any infrastructure in the Caribbean, for example, that could withstand the kind of intensity that this brought. And in terms of what the relief and emergency officers, it's almost unimaginable what they face.
US President Donald Trump says the United States will help Jamaica with the recovery and cleanup. A lot more rainfall is still expected, with the US National Hurricane Center warning of life-threatening flooding and landslides. Ryan Truchelet is a Florida meteorologist.
This is a historical hurricane hit by any standard. It's by far the strongest hurricane to ever make it landfall on the island of Jamaica. This ties the record for the strongest ever Atlantic hurricane landfall with maximum sustained winds of pushing 300 kilometers an hour.
Hurricane Melissa is now expected to continue moving northeast through the Caribbean.
Next up is making landfall west of Guantanamo Bay. And then it'll be moving northeast through the southeastern Bahamas and Turks and Caicos Islands early tomorrow and be in the vicinity of Bermuda overnight Thursday into Friday. So there's more land impacts ahead, still a very strong hurricane.
Florida meteorologist Ryan Truchelet ending that report from Alison Shaw. More fractures are appearing in the fragile Israel-Hamas ceasefire in Gaza. At least 33 Palestinians are said to have been killed in airstrikes after Israel accused Hamas of violating the agreement. Hamas has levelled its own violation, accusations at Israel. And while the United States maintains the ceasefire is holding, some experts believe lasting peace is still out of reach. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
In southern Gaza's city of Khan Yunis, crowds gather as masked Hamas militants enter a tunnel. They return carrying a body on a stretcher. Israel claims Hamas staged the recovery of some hostage remains, which the International Committee of the Red Cross has condemned as unacceptable. Hamas has rejected the allegations. Meanwhile, its armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, has said it will postpone the handover of the recovered body of a missing hostage because of Israeli ceasefire violations, and that any escalation in Israeli attacks in Gaza would hinder search and recovery operations. There are 13 deceased hostages still in Gaza. They were supposed to have been returned within 72 hours of Israel accepting US President Donald Trump's 20-point Gaza peace plan. The ceasefire took effect on October 10. 3 days later, all 20 living Israeli hostages were released in exchange for 250 Palestinian prisoners and more than 1,700 Gazans Israel had detained during the war. But the tit-for-tat provocations have continued.
One might ask, was there ever really a ceasefire? There's been a ceasefire in name, but each day there have been violations of it in one form or another.
That's Ian Parmeter, a research scholar at the Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. He says he's pessimistic about the chances of the ceasefire holding.
Netanyahu is working to two constituencies, to Trump but also to the extreme right wing that is part of his coalition. And trying to please both is going to be very hard for him. And as far as Hamas is concerned, the big issue is the disarming of Hamas. And Hamas has said outright that it won't disarm.
Israel has carried out further attacks. A statement from the office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he directed the military to immediately carry out forceful strikes in the Gaza Strip. Authorities in Gaza saying more than 30 Palestinians were killed. Chris Sidotti, a member of the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, says the ceasefire was precarious right from the start.
The criminal activities of both the Palestinian militant leadership and the Israeli political and military leadership must end. And they will only end when those who are responsible for the crimes are held to account. One of the failures of the 20-point proposal is that there is no provision for accountability.
Donald Trump's plan includes the development of a temporary international stabilization force to deploy in Gaza to train and support what it calls vetted Palestinian police forces. But Prime Minister Netanyahu has said Israel will decide which foreign troops are acceptable. Middle East expert Ian Parmeter says any Arab states involved will want to ensure their peacekeeping, not fighting.
Getting them all together, getting them coordinated and getting them into Gaza in a situation where they are actually supervising a peace, that they're peacekeeping rather than trying to enforce a peace, is still some way off and could be very difficult to do.
Do you think that lasting peace is achievable in the region?
No. No, there are too many extraordinarily difficult issues to be resolved. It's been a source of huge tension across the region for generations now.
Middle East expert Ian Parmeter ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. This is PM. I'm Stephanie Smale. Coming up, an Australian health initiative credited with thousands of fewer preterm and early term births every year, one of the leading causes of death among young children across the world. The Queensland Government has ordered an inquiry into the Year 12 ancient history bungle that's led to at least 140 students studying for the wrong exam. Students at nine high schools, including Top Brisbane School State High, were taught the wrong syllabus for an exam they had to sit today. Students have been assured they won't be disadvantaged grade-wise, but experts argue it shouldn't have happened in the first place. Leanne Perry was a high school principal for 25 years and is now a professor of practice at the Queensland University of Technology. I spoke to her earlier. Professor Perry, thanks for joining us. Given your extensive knowledge about the systems in place to prevent an issue like this, what's your reaction to this mistake?
My reaction was, like I think most of the wider public, one of enormous dismay and disappointment, and my heart went out for the students and families and staff who have been directly impacted by this, and a great sense of disappointment that it could have happened, because I do think such situations should not occur. The senior assessment systems in Queensland, like in all jurisdictions, are extremely well planned. There is communication between the curriculum authority and schools, and I am aware that in this particular case, the change of the focus area for the ancient history was notified twice, first in 2023, then again in 2024. Certainly one of the schools involved, Brisbane State High, had the change indicated on its subject guide for this year. So clearly it had received the communication. So it's disappointing and perplexing, really, as to why this error occurred, not just in one school, but in 9 schools.
The Queensland Government has ordered an investigation into the Queensland Curriculum and Assessment Authority. Are you confident that will deliver the answers the students and parents who are affected will be looking for?
I think it's always important when you have a major mistake such as this that there is an inquiry. I'm absolutely supportive of there being an inquiry. However, I feel it would be too narrow to just be looking at the Queensland Curriculum Authority. It has responsibility for developing the senior syllabuses, for communicating those to schools, for overseeing the assessment that takes place. But it doesn't have responsibility for the actual implementation, the teaching of the subjects in every school. And so I think the inquiry would be too limited if it only focused on the role of the QCAA. I think in a situation such as this, where schools haven't taught the topic that they should have, an inquiry must look at what happened in each one of those schools to find out what went wrong so that we can then put in place preventative mechanisms for the future.
Do you have your own ideas at this stage about what could stop this happening again?
So this year was the first year of the new topic for ancient history. And I think it's wise when there are changes such as that, that I guess you do a belts and braces approach. So 2 memos were sent out, one year and one the following year. I think there is an advantage in ensuring that you do even more reminders to schools, reminders to authorities, reminders to teachers that this is the year the change is happening.
Do you think teaching load, pressure on teachers, teacher shortages need to come into focus given this mistake?
It's possible. All of those things could be factors. And I think that's what we'd be hoping the inquiry would uncover. And I think if we're going to be most effective in preventing these errors, which do have a really big impact emotionally, particularly on the students, we owe it to them to put in place all of the checks we possibly can.
Professor of Practice at the Queensland University of Technology, Leanne Perry there. Preterm birth is the leading cause of death among young children across the world. But there are signs a program being rolled out in Australia is making a difference. A study has shown there's been thousands fewer preterm and early term births a year since the program launched in 2018. Isabel Masali has the details.
Perth midwife Emily Donovan had planned to finish working when she was 32 weeks pregnant with her first child.
And then I had about a week of maternity leave, and then my waters just broke randomly in the middle of the night when I was 33 weeks and 3 days pregnant.
Charlie was taken to the special care nursery. His mother says luckily there were never serious health concerns for him or his brother Sydney, who was also born preterm. That's defined as births before 37 weeks. To much relief, Emily Donovan's third pregnancy was very different.
35 weeks came along, 36, 37, and everyone just, you know, kept messaging me saying, are you still pregnant? Like, what's going on? Like, no one could believe it, me especially. I got all the way to 39 weeks in one day.
So what changed? Well, a preterm birth prevention program may have played a role.
The team were so lovely and warm and caring and felt like a little bit of a safety blanket as well, you know, knowing what could happen, but that we had them on our side.
The program first began in Western Australia in 2014, and with federal funding, it was rolled out nationally in 2018. John Newnham is a professor of obstetrics at the University of Western Australia and the founder of the Australian Preterm Birth Prevention Alliance. He says the program involves seven clinical strategies.
So the first is no pregnancies to be ended until 39 weeks of pregnancy unless there's a medical reason. We measure the length of the cervix, the neck of the womb, at all mid-pregnancy scans. And we introduced measurement of the length of the cervix. If the cervix is short, it predicts preterm birth. If the cervix is long, it predicts term birth. If the cervix is short, she needs to go into treatment starting that day. And it's a simple tablet in the vagina each evening till 36 weeks.
Now a study has shown those relatively simple changes have made a difference. It examined nearly 2 million births.
And in our six-year program, after the first 3 years when we'd lowered the preterm birth rate, the Commonwealth said to us they would like us to focus heavily on lowering the early term birth rate, the 37 to 39 weeks, because of the problems that are occurring in schools. So we then focused heavily on reducing the number of births between 37 and 39 weeks, and we've reduced it by 10%, which is about 4,000 cases prevented each year.
Dr. Nisha Cott is the president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists.
For a country as vast as ours, to be able to reduce the preterm birth rate across the country, across all of the jurisdictions and across rural and urban is a really exciting result to get.
She says at least some of the strategies have become routine practice, but she hopes further work gets underway.
I think one of the things that this study has not shown a reduction is a reduction in the really preterm births that happened before 32 weeks. So I think we need to continue doing the research to find out what works in that group and make sure that we target that group and reduce the preterm births in those groups, because actually the sort of long-term effects from having a preterm baby at less than 32 weeks are even more significant.
The study has been published in the journal The Lancet Obstetrics, Gynecology and Women's Health.
Isabel Massali reporting. A banned T-shirt has sparked a furore in Australian politics. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese under fire for wearing the Joy Division top on a long-distance flight. The opposition leader Susan Lee has accused Mr. Albanese of displaying the wrong values, as Angus Randall reports.
Decades after their music first hit the airwaves, UK band Joy Division still attracts a fiercely loyal following. So much so, there's a brisk trade in T-shirts featuring the cover art from their debut album Unknown Pleasures, based on an image of radio waves from a distant star. And 46 years on, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's choice to wear the shirt has stirred quite a reaction, like this from ABC talkback callers.
His minders should have said, hey, there's unintended consequences here. Just put your suit and tie on.
If it was so offensive, they should have knocked it on the head years ago and then nobody would have been offended.
Joy Division's name comes from a novel written by a Holocaust survivor nearly a decade after the end of the Second World War, which described the concentration camp brothels where female inmates were kept as sexual slaves as Freudenabteilungen, or Joy Divisions. The accuracy of this book remains disputed. However, the novel is definitely the source of the band's name, leading to this from Conservative commentator Shari Markson on Sky News.
Wearing this T-shirt sends a strong signal to anti-Semites. It's deeply insensitive.
Federal opposition leader Susan Lee has called on Anthony Albanese to apologise.
To choose to wear this T-shirt is an insult to all, and it fails the basic tests of leadership.
However, the opposition leader has struggled to get full-throated support from her own party, while her coalition partners, the Nationals, say they don't care. Today, Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg not going so far as to back his leader's call for an apology.
And so the Prime Minister should be careful with the attire that he wears.
However, Susan Lee is keeping up the fight.
I don't take a backward step on my comments.
The Zionist Federation and the Executive Council of Australian Jewry declined to comment on whether the shirt is anti-Semitic. Sarah Schwartz from the Jewish Council of Australia says this concocted outrage makes a mockery of anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism and racism are too serious for cheap political point scoring over a T-shirt.
This example really borders on the comical.
Professor Dennis Altman is a political sociologist and Vice-Chancellor's Fellow with La Trobe University.
I think much more serious is the fact that genuine criticism of Israel is now too often linked to anti-Semitism, which makes it very difficult to have the sort of mature discussion about what Israel is doing that we desperately need to have. And that seems to be much more important than worrying about drawing a very long bow to make some connection between a T-shirt, the name of a band, and the Holocaust.
In a text message with ABC Sydney presenter Hamish McDonald, the Prime Minister said there was no meaning behind it, saying, "Only meaning is it's a cracking album."
Angus Randall there. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Stephanie Smale. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The cost of medical treatments and dental work in Australia can be exorbitant. So, no wonder more and more people are accessing their superannuation funds early to pay for things like IVF and dentist bills. Today, ABC reporter Selena Edmonds on her investigation into how the rules are being exploited. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.